CPR and cardiovascular care updates, follow-up interview, part two. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind all of you that you can find everything available from this show, including articles from me, Jamie Davis, and also other people over at nursingshow.com, as well as links and information to follow up on from each and every episode in the show notes. You'll find a show notes link right at the top of the page. You can go ahead and click that and find each episode listed there. You'll find the most recent episode listed first, and then you can scroll down and go back in time in reverse chronological order. You can also always get back in touch with me. I love to hear from each and every one of you. Send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. And I would also urge you to leave a comment right over on the website. You can leave a comment on most every article over there. There's a comments link right at the top of the page. You can also find comments links at the bottom of each article as well. And I look forward to hearing from you. I do try to return every email I get, and I try to respond back to the comments as they come in as well. What did you think of the last episode, or what are you looking forward to hearing in future episodes? All of that's important information, and of course, any corrections that need to be made. I rely on you, the members of the Nursing Show community, to take care of that. Help me get the best possible information about healthcare, patient care, and being the best nurses we all can be here on The Nursing Show. I'll make that information available, and I look forward to having you all contribute and help out with that. If you'd like to follow me over on Twitter or Facebook, you can find me under the handle PodMedic, twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic. And of course, you can always become a fan of The Nursing Show over on Facebook. If you haven't already done so, I urge you to do that. It's a great way to get additional stuff. I put additional links, information, questions about ideas I have for future episodes all over on the fan page just for the fans. So if you haven't already done that, go to facebook.com/nursingshow, click the like button right there at the top of the page, and then you will become an official fan of The Nursing Show. And questions I ask and things like that will show up in your Facebook feed, and you can follow up and answer those questions or see what other people have proposed. And it's just a great way to become a more involved community member here and participate in The Nursing Show directly. So coming up here in just a sec is the final portion of the interview I had a few weeks back when the new CPR and cardiovascular care guidelines were released, the 2010 ECC update. And I had an opportunity to involve Dr. Monica Kleinman, the incoming chair of the AHA ECC Committee, the Emergency Cardiovascular Care Committee for the American Heart Association. I also brought on a good friend of mine, educator, blogger, and paramedic lieutenant from Hilton Head, South Carolina, Tom Boothelet. And Tom was gracious enough to come on and share his questions and thoughts and comments there as well. Now, I would also urge you to head over and check out one of the most recent episodes of the MedicCast, my other podcast for paramedic and EMS professionals. Tom and I, after we got done talking with Dr. Kleinman, actually did a follow-up discussion about a bunch of things, including tracking cardiac arrest rates in your community. What does it really mean to be survivable from a cardiac arrest? And what are communities actively doing? All parts of the community, not just the EMS system or the hospital system, but all parts of the community doing to contribute to improving cardiac arrest survival. And I think you might be interested in that follow-up discussion. And I posted that as a recent episode over at the MedicCast. So I urge you to head over and check that out. And there'll be a link in the show notes to that episode, as well as the first part of this episode from last week here at The Nursing Show. So we'll get into that in just a second. And I just want to thank you all for checking out the show. Doing such a great job, Tom. I'm just sitting here taking notes so I can make sure I can put all this together later. But Dr. Kleinman, we've moving into some of our advanced care techniques. I noticed there were some changes in our medications, and I know Tom had some questions about that.
But the simplification of the algorithm for advanced cardiac care surprised me. I know there was some simplification in 2005. What was the reasoning behind simplifying that algorithm?
I think that it's similar to everything else that we have been moving toward in the past 10 years, which is let's make sure that we focus on the things that we believe really make a difference in outcome and make sure that those are crystal clear to the provider and not try to make our algorithms so inclusive that you miss the really key points. So it's more of a strategy than necessarily saying that resuscitation itself has gotten simpler. This is a strategy to get that message across and to get the key things to stick.
Getting back to airway just for a moment, I noticed that the guidelines emphasize the importance of continuous quantitative waveform capnography. Mm-hmm. Dr. Kleiman, is this technology the new standard of care for confirmation of tracheal tube placement in the pre-hospital setting?
That is a suggestion by the guidelines. The adult providers and the experts who worked on the adult guidelines felt very strongly that this form of capnography is the most appropriate way to confirm and monitor placement of an endotracheal tube, but as well is a key component of assessing the quality of chest compressions during cardiac arrest. And so it serves multiple purposes, but clearly is the most reliable way to determine if an airway is in the correct position and stays in the correct position, and then has the secondary benefit for following cardiac output, whether you're doing CPR or a patient has recovered circulation after a period of CPR. So I would have to say that the direct answer to your question is, I think this will be considered the new standard.
I'm happy to hear it. And then to sort of wrap up the section on cardiac arrest, one thing that I noticed is that atropine has been removed from the cardiac arrest algorithm for a systole PEA. Is the new emphasis more on the H's and T's?
Well, you're probably wondering what you're going to do with all your atropine now, since it probably was used much more in cardiac arrest than necessarily in bradycardias because they're less common. I don't know that the H's and T's are necessarily going to be increased in prominence. I think the focus on high-quality chest compressions is where I would say any distraction by giving medications will be taken up by more focus on good basic life support techniques, minimizing interruptions, and ensuring that we're performing chest compressions at the right rate and the right depth.
Great. Let's move on to ACLS. One thing I noticed is that undifferentiated broad complex tachycardia with a pulse, now it's acceptable or maybe even encouraged for a trial of adenosine prior to other antiarrhythmics. Could you talk about that?
So we know certainly that patients who have wide complex tachyarrhythmias, a certain proportion of those patients will have supraventricular origin of that rhythm, even though they are demonstrating a wide complex, and that's because they have delayed conduction at the ventricular level. This is something that was done in the pediatric algorithm in 2005, and I think was considered to be reasonable to add to the adult algorithm as well, that a sort of diagnostic test and potential therapeutic trial for someone with that type of rhythm may result in conversion if it is indeed of supraventricular origin. That doesn't mean that that is preferred over other treatments for wide complex tachycardia. It means that it's an option that providers can exercise if they are not having response to the more traditional techniques.
Just out of curiosity, if adenosine terminates a wide complex tachycardia, is that diagnostic that it was, in fact, SVT with aberrancy, or are some types of ventricular tachycardia amenable to adenosine?
To the best of my knowledge, truly ventricular tachycardia is not going to be affected by adenosine, which acts by, as you know, blocking conduction through the AV node. So while I would hesitate to, always say always, the fact that a rhythm would terminate with adenosine just strongly suggests that it's a supraventricular or potentially nodal origin.
A lot of us that have been paramedics, say, for 10, 20 years that have been going through the various national registry experience of mm-hmm. the different, what we call the megacode stations, and we're giving, mm-hmm. say, a third-degree heart block with wide complexes versus, a broad complex tachycardia with a pulse that may be hemodynamically stable, for example. I guess I'm just wondering if there's anything earth-shattering in terms of the types of drugs that we use. For example, is the role, it seems to me, in looking at the bradycardia algorithm, that the role of transcutaneous pacing is no longer recommended above chronotropic agents. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think those things have been equalized to some degree. And I don't know that that's an intentional way of trying to show that we believe one is less important than it was looked at previously. But I think that the admission is that the strength of evidence for some of these things is not good enough to put them, to rank them in superiority the way they may have appeared to be ranked before. For those patients, and of course the majority of your patients are going to have a spontaneous pulse and are not going to be in cardiac arrest, fortunately. Probably the most significant change is the one that we just talked about, which is the option of using adenosine as a diagnostic test and potential therapy for wide complex tachycardias. The use of amiodarone, which was introduced earlier in this decade, continues to be recommended. The use of other medications for the treatment of symptomatic bradycardias has not really changed. So I don't think that there's a whole lot that's going to be different for the provider who is responding to a patient having an acute cardiac arrhythmia as opposed to patients who are having cardiac arrest, where things may appear a little bit different.
How about irregular or polymorphic wide complex tachycardias? Was there any debate about the safety or efficacy of adenosine versus amiodarone versus procainamide for patients that may have an accessory pathway?
Yeah, there is certainly the caveat that for patients who have an irregular tachycardia or who have a polymorphic tachycardia, that one needs to be cautious about using adenosine, and you're right to point that out. The recommendation to consider adenosine is really intended to be for the regular monomorphic ventricular appearing tachycardia and not for those more unusual or aberrant irregular types of rhythms.
And one of the interesting things with regard to the 2010 guidelines in the acute coronary syndromes was the downplaying of the role of oxygen for patients that have an oxygen saturation at or above 94%. What should we take away from the 2010 guidelines as far as the routine administration of oxygen for heart attack patients?
So for a patient who has not experienced a cardiac arrest, our belief is that oxygen is still appropriate and beneficial. There's no suggestion that one should withhold oxygen from a patient who's having an acute coronary syndrome or some other type of medical emergency that is not cardiac arrest. There's certainly debate, and this started with the neonatal population and is spilling over into the older folks, about what's the ideal concentration of oxygen to use during resuscitation from cardiac arrest. But at this point, we really don't have any evidence to suggest that you should use anything other than 100% oxygen while you're in the process of performing CPR and attempting return of circulation. In the post-resuscitation phase, that's where hyperoxia in the setting of reperfusion has the most potential harm. And so that's where we're really concentrating our message on avoiding excessive oxygen exposure in that population, but it's not intended for the people in a pre-arrest state.
The recommendations regarding out-of-hospital 12-lead ECGs seem relatively unchanged since 2005. Did the review committees have any thoughts on studies involving medics activating the cardiac cath lab from the field, or ED bypass to the cath lab protocols, or policies to reduce door-to-balloon times?
It's a terrific question. I would say that that certainly continues to be an important factor, particularly, as you know, for the STEMI-type patients, that having an organized system of care that reduces that door-to-balloon time is very important. It was not one of the topics of tremendous review and discussion in this guidelines process, and I think it's one of those things that we need to continually look at. You know, one disadvantage of these periodic publications of new guidelines is that one has the sense that everything is now going to stay the same for the next 5 years, and that's certainly not intended to be the case. We look at this as a dynamic process, and if more information comes out about that process sometime between now and 2015, it's certainly possible that there will be interim recommendations made to emphasize a practice or a change that appears to save lives.
Another thing that I liked about the 2010 guidelines is the emphasis on the importance of considering the possibility of right ventricular involvement with acute inferior STEMI, and then using nitroglycerin with caution, if at all, particularly when the blood pressure is marginal. Do you think it's very important for EMS systems to implement 12-lead programs, not just for triaging patients to the appropriate hospital, but also that they can make wise clinical decisions in the field?
Yes, I think pre-hospital care has really been a segment of our care system that has had some very important contributions to our ability to diagnose and begin treatment for patients well before they reach the hospital setting. And this is one example where having that information can certainly make a difference in how the patient's approached, potentially where the patient's transported. So I'd certainly encourage that systems that have the technology or have the option to get the technology take full advantage of it.
I guess my last question relates back to post-cardiac arrest care and the therapeutic hypothermia. When I look back at the 2000 guidelines and then the 2005 guidelines and a recent discussion that we had on the new EMS Research podcast, there seems to have been quite a lag time or delay between the 2005 guidelines being released and many of its recommendations being implemented in clinical practice, not just in the pre-hospital setting, but also inside the hospital. What suggestion or recommendation would you have, not only for EMS systems, but also for receiving hospitals, if they want to sort of catch up with the times and start to implement things like therapeutic hypothermia?
Well, there are a couple of programs that are available to support various parts of the chain of survival in adopting these new guidelines, or I should say perhaps becoming compliant with the new guidelines. So there is a program that you've probably heard of called Get With The Guidelines that was really aimed at hospitals that were desiring to implement them and monitor their impact on a system-wide basis. That program is still available through the American Heart Association and is something that many hospitals have taken advantage of. The nice thing about it is that it also provides recommendations on how to measure and assess whether interventions are being being used and then what their impact is on outcome, which, as we talked about earlier, is an important part of the whole approach. The therapeutic hypothermia is something that has, as you know, grown up in individual systems, but is certainly less well organized than perhaps some of the other things that we have done systematically for emergency care. And there's a lot of resources available both through the American Heart Association and other organizations. And I would refer people to the website, heart.org/CPR, which has a lot of material and a lot of links that can send you to places which will have more information about all of these topics, but as well therapeutic hypothermia. And there have also been some interim statements that have been published that have some good details on the practicalities of implementing a therapeutic hypothermia protocol for post-arrest patients. So those references are included in the guidelines. And if you can look at that list of references, which is obviously long, but look specifically for the ones in the therapeutic hypothermia section, there's some really good information there.
Great.
Just as a wrap up, I know you've got some other things to get to, Dr. Kleiman, and we really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us. But if you had a message for the pre-hospital care professional in the field as they look at these new guidelines, what should they keep in mind? What's the most important thing you'd like to leave them with as they go out there and care for the cardiac arrest patient?
Well, I would have to say, as someone who's done pre-hospital care and in-hospital care, it's important to know that what they're doing makes a difference. We are seeing the impact of high-quality pre-hospital care every day on lives of children and adults. Certainly, you know, all of us in our professions see the routine nature of a lot of what we do, but the fact that these professionals continuously try to improve, are dedicated to their continuing education and to the patients that they serve, it's making a difference. Outcomes are improving. It may appear to be happening at an infinitesimally slow pace to some people, but all of these things cumulatively are making a difference. And everyone in this system is tremendously important to the ultimate survival of a patient with an acute cardiac problem.
Time to wrap up this episode of The Nursing Show, and I do want to thank everybody for checking out this week's show. If you have any comments or questions that you'd like to share with me or something you'd like to ask of somebody like Tom Boutelet, who was one of our guests this time around, go ahead and shoot me an email to nursingshow@gmail.com. Of course, you can always leave comments over on The Nursing Show site. Go to nursingshow.com, and you'll find articles there as well as additional links and information, study aids and resources for student nurses, and also links to everything discussed in each and every episode in that show notes link right at the top of the page. You can go ahead and leave comments there as well. And I look forward to hearing back from you about what you think of the Nursing Show site. Of course, you can always get in touch with me by following me over on Twitter or Facebook, twitter.com/podmedic and facebook.com/podmedic to catch up with me there. And don't forget, please, please become a fan of the Nursing Show on Facebook. facebook.com/nursingshow, and then just click the like button right there at the top of the page. I share additional questions, comments, and really converse a lot more in depth with the listeners that are fans over there at Facebook. So you have an opportunity to discuss things directly with me and back and forth with other listeners in the comments on the different things over at the Facebook fan page. So again, check it out over at facebook.com/nursingshow. And don't forget, click that like button at the top of the page. We're going to go ahead and close out this episode, and we will close out the show with a PodSafe song. This is going to be Laura Clapp's Not Responsible. If you like what you hear, you can check out her music in the link provided in the show notes, and I would urge you to do that. You know, follow up on these links and let these artists know that you like their music and you want to go ahead and check it out. There's always often a link to check out their music directly in iTunes, so you can check out their songs there and maybe purchase one or two. You know, it's great to support these independent artists who share their songs with listeners like you here at The Nursing Show. And of course, viewers as well, those of you that are watching over at nursingshow.tv or on the Roku or other TV box in your living room, welcome to The Nursing Show. That's it. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again next week, every Friday, with another episode of The Nursing Show. In the meantime, please don't forget to keep in mind that you stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Wrap your guilt around me when you don't get your way. And you bleed all this blame. Clean your cut, wrap it up, take care of your own pain. 'Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Why can't you let it go? Oh, yeah. 'Cause all that you're crying about happened 2 years ago or more. You hit rock bottom, now you're pacing its floor. But what I'm talking about, it's climbing out, well, no one's help but your own. 'Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Grow some backbone, stand up for yourself. 'Cause I ain't taking no more, and neither is no one else. Oh, 'cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not so sorry. So it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not. I'm so sorry. Oh, oh, I'm so sorry, baby, but I'm not. Sorry, so sorry, baby, but I'm not. Sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible.